Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello, everybody, and let's talk about B-37. It's not a bingo number. It's the anonymous juror in the Zimmerman trial who gave an interview to Anderson Cooper on CNN Monday night and, as you probably know, said she was working on a book deal and has been getting a lot of backlash ever since. Today we learned that four of the five other jurors have released a statement saying she does not speak for them. So let's listen to some clips and see what we can learn from this whole sequence of events. To help us with this, Slate senior editor and court watcher, Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Nice to be here.
And let's start with the bombshell that race did not come up in the deliberation room, according to B-37. Here's what she had to say.
Was that a common belief on the jury that race was not, that race did not play a role in this?
I think all of us thought race did not play a role.
So nobody felt race played a role?
I don't think so.
None of the jurors?
I can't speak for them. That wasn't
part of the discussion in the jury room?
No, we never had that discussion.
It didn't come up, the question of did George Zimmerman profile Trayvon Martin because he was African American?
No, I think he just profiled him because he was the neighborhood watch and he profiled anybody that came in acting strange.
Juror B-37 with Anderson Cooper. You know, Emily, on that very last thing she said, that Trayvon Martin was acting strange. Isn't one of the premises of the prosecution that he was not acting suspiciously, and that's the main reason for people also thinking he was profiled? Was he doing something strange, as people like the jurors who paid close attention to the evidence might think?
No, I don't think there's any reason to think that Trayvon Martin was doing something strange. And to me, the clip that you just played is, it makes me want to weep because it's so indicative of the way in which the juror saying that race didn't matter. But the only reason to think that Trayvon Martin was doing something strange was to think that having a black kid walk down the street in a hoodie was somehow strange or, you know, dangerous. And it just seems
Well, there was this, somewhere there was language about that he was lingering or just looking at the houses. Didn't Zimmerman tell that to 911, something to that effect?
Yes, he did suggest that, but it just doesn't seem like there's any reason to think that was happening, especially if you consider this in the context of all the 911 calls Zimmerman made and the fact that he seemed to interpret his job as neighborhood watch as being very suspicious of a lot of different people, many of whom happen to be black.
So, listeners, what can we learn from Juror B-37? Did you watch that interview on CNN? Have you been listening to the clips or the coverage or the backlash since? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Does what she says make you want to weep like it makes Emily Bazelon from Slate? 212-433-9692. Is it a problem that the jurors didn't discuss race, if she's even accurate? We know that four of the other five jurors issued a statement saying she doesn't speak for them. We don't know
right.
The details of how. But from a strictly legal standpoint, it wasn't really relevant, right?
Strictly legally, right. I mean, we're supposed to have a colorblind system in which justice is not meted out according to race. On the other hand, in this case, I think to ignore race is to ignore this really salient factor that affected Zimmerman's judgment, I think, and there's some evidence for that. So I'm not sure that ignoring race really can work in this situation.
Over at Slate, I'll tell you what, we'll play another clip from Juror B-37. The interview on CNN where she states that the 911 operator encouraged George Zimmerman to pursue Trayvon Martin, even though the overwhelming reporting and analysis seems to have it the other way around. Here she is.
Do you think he's guilty of something?
I think he's guilty of not using good judgment. When he was in the car and he called 911, he shouldn't have gotten out of that car. But the 911 operator also, when he was talking to him, kind of egged him on. I don't know if it's their policy to tell them what to do, not to get out of the car, to stay in their car. But I think he should have said, stay in your car, not can you see where he's gone?
So the 911 operator egged him on, Emily. Most people heard that as at least a recommendation, even if not an order, that he remain in the car, not egged him on. So what do you learn from B-37's perception on that?
I mean, I think it, to me, suggested that she was really interpreting the facts in a light favorable to Zimmerman, because what the operator, the dispatcher, actually said was, you don't need to do that, when Zimmerman suggested he was going to get out of the car. So it seems clear that, as you said, this was some kind of check against taking that step. And to hear her have it backwards makes you just wonder what about the lens through which she was viewing the evidence.
And even though B-37 stated that race wasn't explicitly discussed, many have read coded racism in her language. Here's another clip from her CNN interview.
And she was embarrassed by being there because of her education and her communication skills that she just wasn't a good witness.
Did you find it hard at times to understand what she was saying?
A lot of the times. Because a lot of the times she was using phrases I have never heard before and what they meant.
Well, there she was talking about the witness, Trayvon's friend, Rachel Jontel. I should have said that before we played the clip. But I don't know. Is it fair to interpret racial bias in juror B-37's comments there? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I mean, Rachel Jontel was a really problematic witness. She didn't seem like she wanted to be there. She was confusing at times. So that part didn't bother me so much. There are a couple of other quotes from the juror, though, where she talks about, like, how they live their lifestyle that sounds like she's really distancing herself from Trayvon Martin's family, from black people in general. I mean, I suppose there are other interpretations of that, but that one crossed my mind when I was listening.
Well, let's take some phone calls. As you might imagine, Emily, our board just completely exploded with people calling in as soon as we said, what have you learned from the juror B-37 interview? And they are, you know, filling the board, and they're all over the board in terms of perception. So let's hear what some people have to say. Yvonne in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Yvonne.
Good morning. I am a little puzzled. There was a phone call in question, and it was as to who was screaming on the phone. Why is it that no one asked whose phone it was? Why wasn't there a phone record in place to see whose phone it was? And also, he was in a neighborhood, and from what I understand, it was not his own neighborhood. He was in his father's neighborhood.
And what does that suggest to you?
That suggests to me that he was a vigilante, that he went outside the scope of where he was supposed to be and did what he wasn't supposed to do.
I see. On that point, Emily, I'm not sure you would call that not Zimmerman's own neighborhood.
Yeah, right. I think that's fair. I mean, I think Zimmerman played this role of neighborhood watch. On the point about the call, I think maybe there's a little bit of confusion here. The big unanswered question is who was screaming on the 911 tape. So that wasn't audio that came from a phone call. It came from someone else, a neighbor, called into 911. So it was her phone number, and you could hear the screams in the background. And we just don't know who was screaming. All the experts who testified said they couldn't determine that. And both Zimmerman's family members and Martin's family members each said it was their son, their family member, you know, who was screaming. But it's just impossible to know from screams, apparently. You can't interpret the evidence.
Though another thing that B-37 said was that she and the other jurors pretty much concluded that that was Zimmerman screaming, which seems like a reasonable conclusion.
It's reasonable, but I just don't think we know the answer. I mean, when the facts of this case first broke, I really cottoned on to this 911 call because it seemed like if we knew the answer to who was screaming, that would tell us so much about who the victim in this fight was, who was losing the fight, who was really in trouble, who felt like their life was threatened. But the experts couldn't answer that question, and so I'm not sure. It seems, sure, you could think it was George Zimmerman, but you could also think it was Trayvon Martin.
Sean in Great Neck, you're on WNYC. Sean, thanks a lot for calling.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm one of the very few that actually thinks the jury got it just right. And I'm actually very relieved by everything I heard from this B-37 juror. I thought she was the only one from who I've heard, especially grounded in the facts and the evidence, who applied the law unlike every other pundit, unlike every other person I kind of meet on the street, is people have their opinions despite the facts. Now, let's assume, for the sake of argument, that George Zimmerman provoked this whole thing. Let's just even assume that he was a racist. Now, that doesn't mean that even if he did all those things and he thought all those things, that he wouldn't have been justified to use self-defense if the fight got out of hand to where it in fact got. So the only question in my mind really is the undetermined question, exactly as described by a witness, which is who was screaming on that call. And if there is a question, apparently there is with most people, and apparently there was with the jury, that it could be Trayvon Martin just as it could have been Zimmerman. I happen to think it's Zimmerman. All of the evidence points that way. But the fact that there is this question means that there is reasonable doubt. And the jury could not have concluded. I mean, for them to conclude, to convict George Zimmerman, they had to conclude that it was Trayvon Martin, in my opinion. Well, and they could not have done that by the admission of even this, this young lady you have on.
Sean, thank you very much. But I think, Emily, that it goes to a question of what the law was and what the charges were. Tell me if I'm wrong. Because I'm not sure that the self-defense law in every state would have given him the rights that the Florida self-defense law gave him to shoot even under those circumstances. And what the charges were under that law seemed to discount the possibility that he could be charged for anything that he did to precipitate the incident without cause. And there I wonder if the prosecutor brought the wrong charges.
Well, that's a really good question, whether manslaughter would have been the better way to go to begin with. I mean, there is something
Or something about, even less. Reckless endangerment. I don't know.
Yes. No, I think that's a really good question. You know, there's a problem here with both Florida law and more broadly with self-defense, and that is that in a self-defense case, if you feel like you have a reasonable fear of grave bodily harm and you say self-defense, it's up to the prosecution to disprove that. Now, if there are no witnesses and the other person is dead, that can be really hard to do. And so that, I think, is part of what we're seeing the struggle the prosecution had here, although I also think that the prosecution, the lawyers, just didn't put on a very convincing case. And then you also have the problem of how it took 6 weeks for charges to be brought, and the police may very well have botched the case along the way. And even juror B37 said that there were some mistakes made in terms of how evidence was handled that might have affected how the case came to trial.
So one more thing. There's one more clip of her. There's been this idea that Trayvon Martin shares in the blame for what happened to him, and some have argued that he was essentially on trial for his own murder. So let's hear what B37 said about that.
I mean, it's what happened. It's sad. It's a tragedy this happened, but it happened. I think both were responsible for the situation they had gotten themselves into. I think both of them could have walked away. It just didn't happen.
And this, Emily, I've been hearing more and more since after the trial than even before, that both of them could have walked away. It didn't just happen. That while Zimmerman overreacted, that Trayvon Martin also overreacted to being followed because he wasn't necessarily going to be assaulted. There's no way for us to ever know, I don't think, because I think a gap in the evidence is what actually happened between the time that Zimmerman got out of the car and Martin actually turned on him. But what do you think about all that?
I think that's right. You know, it's possible that if Trayvon Martin's family brings a civil suit for his wrongful death against George Zimmerman, that Zimmerman will actually have to answer questions under cross-examination. But unless and until that happens, we don't even have his account unfiltered. You know, we know what he told the police, but we have not listened to him answer questions from an opposing attorney. And so, to me, you're right exactly about that gap. We know what happened on the dispatch call. We have Rachel Dentile's testimony that, you know, Martin was worried about someone following him. But we just don't know how that physical altercation started. And that seems to me to be this crucial gap that, you know, lots of people interpret in either Zimmerman or Martin's favor, kind of depending on your predisposition toward these facts.
The other jurors who've distanced themselves from B-37's remark, and according to B-37 herself, the jury was initially split with three believing Zimmerman guilty and three considering him to be not guilty. Do you think that she's an outlier?
I think she was on the side of the jury that, you know, won the day in the sense that she thought that Zimmerman was not guilty from the beginning. But it is interesting that these other four jurors have come forward to sign a statement saying that her views don't reflect theirs. So I think she is going beyond what other people in the jury feel comfortable with. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what they're taking issue with because they weren't specific. But I was so struck by how she kept calling Zimmerman George over and over again, like he was someone she was familiar with. And she expresses a lot of empathy toward him, and you don't really hear that from her about Trayvon Martin to the same degree.
Emily Bazelon, court watcher from Slate, as we ask, what can we learn from the interview with juror B-37, as she's known? And, you know, that's because the jurors in this high-profile case for their own safety were allowed to keep their names out and be anonymous, so she's juror B-37. Jamar in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jamar.
Hi, I just wanted to say a couple of things. One, in graduate school years ago, I had a professor who encouraged us not to find simple solutions to complex problems. And being a Southerner originally, it sounds very much that this idea to disregard race was some post-racial fantasy that came from the judge all the way down. Secondly, I think disregarding race is as heinous as disregarding gender in a rape trial. Thirdly, I'd like to say that as a 38-year-old black man, when I go into a neighborhood and kill a curly-headed white 15-year-old kid, and the full resources of this nation are behind, you know, vindicating me for being a hero, then maybe, you know, a race-neutral situation is possible. But I don't believe that anyone in their right mind believes in this country that would be the case, that black men could walk around freely armed, killing 15-year-old white boys and having this kind of question. So those are the three things I have to say.
You think even if it had gotten to that point where the hypothetical 15-year-old white boy was on top of the black man and pounding on him?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think I'd have a white woman calling me, Georgie, and empathizing. I'm sorry, So to me, it's just as heinous as disregarding gender in a rape trial.
Jamar, thank you very much. Emily, why do you think the prosecution didn't try to make race more of an issue? If they had to hang their case on what Zimmerman did to provoke the incident because self-defense seemed to be, a legitimate defense once the altercation had begun, why do you think they didn't go after the notion of him racially profiling Trayvon Martin, which I know the judge didn't allow that term in, but they could have done it in some way?
I think to some degree they did try. I mean, there are moments on the 911 tape where it kind of sounds like Zimmerman is up to the line of profiling. The problem is that he didn't actually say anything that was directly offensive, right? At first, when we listened to that 911 take, it seemed like he'd used a racial slur, but then when you really listen, it sort of fell apart. You couldn't tell what word he was using. So I don't think they had that much to go on. It's this crazy thing where at once race is obviously incredibly central to the case, and I really understand why Jamar feels the way he does, your caller just now. I've heard so many stories like that from black men, and it's really making me think again about all of those stereotypes and inequities that we all live with day to day. But it's in this funny, slippery way, the case didn't have a lot of direct evidence that Zimmerman was being racist.
And your colleague at Slate, William Salatan, wrote a piece that he saw as counterintuitive yesterday, arguing that Zimmerman is a victim of the same knee-jerk judgment by the media that critics have accused him of in his pursuit of Trayvon Martin, because there's no evidence that Zimmerman had a racist or prejudiced intention. We assume it because Trayvon Martin appeared not to be doing anything wrong or anything suspicious, and he went after him.
Yeah, I mean, I read Will's piece with interest. I want to distance myself from it. I don't actually think that that's true, that we don't have any evidence of Zimmerman's racism. When you look back on his record of who he was calling 911 about, it was often black people, and he talked about their race, even if it wasn't in a hugely incendiary way. It's just hard for me to believe, in the same way it is for Jamar, that if there had been a white teenager walking down the street, the same thing would have happened.
I guess if he was on the stand, Zimmerman, then they could have cross-examined him about the 911 call where, you know, looking at Trayvon as an individual, he referred to these effing punks.
Yeah.
But, of course, that could just mean punks. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean black punks.
Right. It could. I mean, this is the thing. This evidence, it really is in the eye of the beholder, because there isn't something hugely definitive there. It's the same thing we were talking about before. Who started this fight? Well, who do you think would start a fight in a situation like this? Because we just don't know the answer. So you're left with your own suppositions.
Dave in East New York, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Great discussion. I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, this Stand Your Ground law is a law in about 24 states. It's nothing new. Trayvon Martin happened to be a victim of a really bad law. Unfortunately, I think what George Zimmerman may have done was actually studied the law and had a penchant to harm someone. Saw an opportunity where he could be in a situation with no witnesses, and he took full advantage of this law.
But he doesn't have a history of being violent that we know of, despite all his apparent.
He doesn't have a history of being convicted of a felony. He was charged with domestic violence. He was charged as assault. He was fired from a job as a bouncer. The man had a problem. All right, and he certainly had a problem. Confronting Trayvon Martin. He could have confronted him from a distance with a gun and still not shot him. I think he was bent on harming his kid. But it doesn't even matter at the end of the day. The law allowed it to happen. And this is the problem I have with the media. The media is still talking about the case. This isn't about the case. It's about a law that allows people to do what he did and get away with it. Now, I have with white people is that white people should be just as outraged as they were when Nicole Simpson was killed. All right, but they're not. And they're not because they see Trayvon Martin is getting what he deserved. All right, I've read a lot of stuff on the internet, and you should see what people are saying.
It is unbelievable what some people are saying. Although I would say, in fairness, there are a lot of white people who are absolutely outraged about this and making it known. Dave, thank you. Please call us again. He talks about the Stand Your Ground law being the bottom line here. Emily, you've written about that, and I want to play a clip of the Attorney General, Eric Holder, who actually came out and made a statement about that yesterday.
We must stand our ground to ensure that our laws reduce violence and take a hard look at laws that contribute to more violence than they prevent.
So, Emily, how much do you think the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, which was not invoked by the defense per se, but which was raised by the judge in her instructions to the jury, as I understand it.
Yeah.
What role do you think that law played?
Well, it was hugely important in the beginning before Zimmerman was charged. It was the reason the cops gave for not pressing this forward with this investigation, and it may have hindered them from collecting the evidence and preserving it in the way they should have. And, you know, Dave, your caller is absolutely right that the law, it sort of encourages violence by giving people much more license to use deadly force when they feel threatened. We don't have this law in all the states, and there's no evidence that people are safer in states where they have no duty to retreat. That's the other rule, right? That if you're not in your house, you're supposed to back up and try to get away rather than using force. And this is hardly the only case in Florida where we see someone use force in a way that seems rash and in which a death happens that could have been prevented otherwise.
What do you think about the book contract idea, by the way? Were you as outraged about that as some people, or, hey, she had this experience, she's a person in the world, let her write a book?
you know, I mean, I think it's really tacky to have that come up, especially so quickly, and that's why she backed away from it. I understand that people are tempted to capitalize on experiences like this, and I've written a book myself. I can't condemn, you know, book writing generally. She has a perfect right to do it, but I don't think it was a smart move in terms of making people feel like she had a kind of, you know, wider perspective and could be trusted.
And one last thing. In her voir dire interview, which has now gone public as a video, B37 stated that she consumes almost no media besides the Today Show, and she only uses newspapers to line her parrots' cages. So maybe she really had no understanding of how her comments would come across, since, you know, when she kind of apologized for the interview yesterday, she said, I didn't realize that people were so upset about this case. I mean, that's really insulated for somebody who actually lives in Sanford, Florida. Does that make her an ideal juror for the defense, though, around the country in all kinds of cases?
I mean, what I find so frustrating about this is the notion that we should be looking for jurors who, for whom somehow impartiality means ignorance. I just don't understand that. It seems to me like you can read about a case, you can know about it, and you can still set aside what you thought you believed when you become a juror and listen to the evidence from the beginning in trial and limit what you decide based on what you hear in the courtroom. Lots of jurors have been able to do that. I desperately wish that our system would start moving away from this idea that it's better to know nothing, because then you end up with people who just have insulated from current events and from the real world and are really not representative.
Emily Bazelon, court watcher and senior editor for Slate, and you can hear her on the Slate Politics podcast every weekend here on WNYC. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And on this and more, New York City mayoral hopeful Bill de Blasio coming up next. Stay tuned.